Good afternoon. My name is Sharon, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Partnering with the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Emily Lord, Executive Director, Healthcare Ready, you may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you, everyone, and thanks, everyone, for joining us today. I'm actually going to turn it over to Greg Borrell of SNS to kick it off with a few words.
Thanks, Emily. Appreciate everybody joining us again today. This is Greg Borrell, and for those of you who have not met or who don't know me, I'm the Director of the Division of Strategic National Stockpile at CDC. We've been conducting a series of these to try to help people understand better how the pharmaceutical supply chain works and how to create partnerships and good relationships with that supply chain. So far, we've talked about a variety of subjects related to how pharmaceuticals and, to a certain extent, medical devices, but really pharmaceuticals here, move from a manufacturer into a normal operating supply chain or how they can move into a surging supply chain. Today, we're going to have more conversation directly about pharmacies. And so we're going to hear from Emily Lord from Healthcare Ready, the executive director there, and she's going to talk more about that. And then we're excited to have David Starr, who is the director of countermeasures response at the New York City Department of Health and Hygiene, Mental Hygiene. He's being joined by Vibhuti Arya, doctor of pharmacy, Allison Scaccia, and Eric Medina, who all work with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene on the medical countermeasures issues. And I think some of the work that they've done with local pharmacies there will be interesting to all of you. With that, I'm going to stop and let Emily take it away.
Great. Thank you. And before we get started, please take a second to answer the poll on the right-hand side of your screen. We're going to have polls throughout the call, and it's really helpful to us as we're going to understand what all of your affiliations and opinions are on a lot of things. And additionally, if you have questions throughout the webinar, feel free to add them into the chat window, and they can go to our operator here in the room with me so she can let me know if we have any questions. And then at the end of the call, we'll open it up with the operator to everyone on the line. So as we talked about today, we're here to talk about building relationships with the pharmaceutical supply chain. I'm going to be talking overall and why it matters, what the trends are in the field, and what people are looking at. And then David is going to go ahead and talk more about what's happening in New York, how they've dealt with the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, what they did during Sandy, and how that's really led to some wonderful and strong relationships throughout the city. Can you please move to the next slide? Great. And my goal today here with you is to understand a lot of you may or may not have relationship with the pharmaceutical supply chain and with pharmacies, and to really understand why that could be a great benefit to you in public health and what you can really do to start engaging with them and how it can really help with your preparedness and for your response, but also to understand the best ways to go about doing that. Because I think a lot of folks, from what I've heard anecdotally, is they wanted to make relationships. They went out, they've started to try to build those, but there's been challenges along the way. So I'm gonna talk a little bit too about how to approach that, how to think about doing it, and how to work with both groups. Before I get started in the meat of my remarks, we have another poll that's coming up. Give it a second. And we would like to know from all of you, does your organization currently have formal partnerships with pharmacy in place? So right now we're asking if down at the dispenser level, down at the pharmacies, do you already have relationships built? So please just take a second to answer the poll. And can we get a close on that poll, please? Great. So it's interesting. It looks like there's a mix that some of you have not considered it yet. And that's great, because I think that means there's a tremendous amount of opportunity. And hopefully we can talk to you a little bit about why that could be useful to you. Can we move on to the next slide? It takes just a second to close the polls, and we get into that moment. So Healthcare Ready, a lot of you have probably heard of us. I'm just going to talk for just a brief minute about who we are and what we do so you can understand why I'm here on this call today. But we're a nonprofit. We've been around for 10 years. This is our 10-year anniversary, created after Hurricane Katrina. And we started out with the name RX Response. And our mission in that for that first 8 years of our lives was really to ensure that patients had continued access to medicines no matter what happened. And in the past couple of years, we've expanded that so that patients have continuous access to healthcare at a much more broad level. But our heart and our history is really into medicines and making sure we understand how the supply chain works, making sure we partner public and private sector health together, and making sure that they are talking to each other, communicating, and really helping to help the patients on the ground. A lot of the things we do as an organization, we work at that intersection of public-private to share best practices, help with collaboration, and build partnerships. But also, we do a lot of project work like this and policy work and reports on a lot of the critical issues in that. But really, our mission is to ensure that no matter what happens, healthcare systems and public health are strong and tied together so that we are resilient all the time. Because as you know, it's well known, if you're not strong before something happens, when a crisis occurs, an infectious disease outbreak or a disaster, it's a lot less likely that your community is going to recover. One of the other things we do that's very unique as a nonprofit is we actually activate in times of disaster. So we provide all of our response activities for free to all government officials at any level. And we've done it for 60 events as of this time. So we provide technical assistance and we support emergency operation centers to have information sharing, to communicate with each other, to know what the challenges are and know how to solve them. So it's been a lot of events over the past decade. And infectious disease responses, we were there for a year for H1N1. We're just coming off of almost a year on Ebola and moving right into Zika. So consider us as a resource when you're having an event to help you. If you're having trouble understanding what's happening within the medicine supply chain, within healthcare, and you're trying to make sure that all of these things are running smoothly, reach out to us. We basically operate and get questions of all sorts at all different kinds, and we'll work to solve whatever it is. If it's things of making sure that things can get from point A to point B and deliveries can be made, or gas gets to whatever generator it needs to, or patient assistance programs, or helping with donations and brokering it, we're a resource for all of that. And the last thing I'm going to talk about before I move on is our RX Open Map. So this is a map that is free, and it's a way for you and for way for the public to understand what pharmacies are open and operating in a disaster-affected area. So we actually can understand from who's billing what pharmacies, and we map over 66,000 pharmacies throughout the United States. We know which ones have power, which ones have communications, and which ones are likely to be open. So this is a resource for you as well so that you can understand where your needs are and also where to send patients so they can have the coverage they need. We activate this map at the request of public health and emergency responders. So if you have an event where you think you might need a tool like this, please just reach out to us and we can have a conversation about turning it on. Okay, enough about me. So why are pharmacies good partners? It's the topic of partnering with pharmacy, it's pretty new. You know, before H1N1, people didn't really think about pharmacies as partners in public health preparedness until they became vaccination sites. Before that, you think of pharmacy really as just a place to get your prescription filled in normal times, but not really as a critical partner. But pharmacy is everywhere. You know, people need it. It's basically, on average, people are going to the pharmacy every single month, and 94% live within 5 miles of a pharmacy. It's really hard to find another part of healthcare that is as ubiquitous and as accessible as pharmacy, and people trust it. So it's a great tool because 75% have the honesty and ethics of a pharmacist is very high. So it really is a place where people go to routinely interact with a healthcare provider and really understand what they need and to get care and to answer questions. So it's really an untapped resource in a lot of these different spaces. Next slide, please. But really, pharmacy as we know it has changed. So what you think of as pharmacy as just you know, calling in or having your doctor send in a prescription, showing up and getting it refilled, that's really just the tip of the iceberg of what's happening with pharmacies these days. It's a field that's rapidly, rapidly changing. It's really a place now where they're offering all sorts of different public health capabilities. There's now, you know, this series of different clinics, minute clinics and other types of clinics actually within the pharmacies. And pharmacists themselves who are offering more and more services as they go on. So really, all of these new capabilities make pharmacy a better partner than they've ever been before, a partner that has a lot of different capabilities that you can use as you're trying to do a lot of different things in your planning and in your response. And it's also really unique because it sits in the intersection of a lot of different parts of healthcare. You know, they're in routine contact with doctor's offices. They're always talking to the supply chain and getting distributors. They're dealing with insurers, a lot of them are. So they have a lot of insight, and there's a lot of resources that can be brought to bear when you're thinking about pharmacies. One of the big ones is this trend that's happening now in the space called collaborative practice agreements. So these are formal relationships between one pharmacist or one pharmacy and a doctor's office or a different physician that allows different authorities to be given to the pharmacist. It's really a tool that's expanded the scope of what pharmacists are allowed to do and how they can serve their clients. So it's really interesting, the things they're allowed to do now. And it's, as I said, it's one pharmacist, one doctor. So there's really no two collaborative practice agreements that look the same. Some are a little bit wider than that, but they're very unique. But they give the pharmacist the ability to do different things. In some states, they allow them to test for things like the flu. And if the test comes back positive in one of those rapid diagnostics, they can immediately dispense Tamiflu. So cutting out the need for a patient to have to go to their doctor's office and then go to their pharmacy and do different things. As you know, they're allowed to do now, all 50 states are allowed to do flu vaccines, but a lot of states are doing a lot of additional vaccines as well. Pneumococcal, zoster, there's a lot of things out there that they're able to do and have different tests. And in addition to that, there's even some of these collaborative practice agreements where pharmacists have the ability to take a look and modify the medicine the patients are taking, if they need a different dose, if they need some different substitutions or things like that. And these are authorities that they really never had before. And it's a massive trend that's taking wave throughout the United States. And actually, on the next slide, we have a map. So this is a CDC map. It's a couple of years old right now, so I wouldn't guarantee anything on this map, but it really shows states and their authorities that they have to do this. And these are not disaster related. These are collaborative practice agreements that give pharmacists authority all the time or in different situations depending on what the agreement is. So it really is a whole new way. And we're happy to share this map out with anyone if they're wanting it more specifically. But it really is a whole new set of resources for pharmacists. So I'm going to pause here and just take a poll again. How many people were actually aware before that information about collaborative practice agreements and these trends? Yeah, it's interesting. We're seeing, as the results are sort of coming in, we're seeing that a lot of people were not familiar or just a little familiar. And frankly, they're a little bit confusing. You know, you don't have a lot of places where they're widespread, where there's a whole wide area that has the same kind of agreements. There are laws now that are looking to be passed throughout the country that are changing that. Idaho actually just this previous spring put into place some of the most comprehensive legislation where it allows the state public health department, when they see fit, to come up with a statewide collaborative practice agreement with all of the pharmacies in the state. So if they deem it necessary in an event or for whatever need, it really gives them authority on when they get to do it and what they do it with, but they can actually make one of these collaborative practice agreements statewide. And that's the trend we've seen a lot in the Pacific Northwest of letting them have more. They tend to be more on the cutting edge of a lot of these changes, but really trying to find ways to take this from just a one doctor, one provider to broader public health tools that can be covered in a lot of different areas. So it's really interesting to think about the capabilities of pharmacy during their normal routine business, think about I think their resources for information sharing, their resources for understanding the needs are probably a great surveillance tool because they're going to see a lot of the symptoms coming in right away. But on top of that, they're also a great tool in those actual times of disaster. So there's a lot you can do to build your relationships and work with them ahead of time, but frankly, they're a wonderful tool when you're actually having an event. And I think there's a lot of efforts as well right now that are looking at preparedness and pandemics, looking at pharmacies as vaccination sites, a lot of broader outbreak efforts that are looking at. I know a number of states have looked at using pharmacies to actually dispense in times of stockpile or in times of pandemics, but there's also resources that they can have in more immediate needs and in more natural disasters and other types of events. And it's really incredibly important. You know, it's one thing to have those partnerships, you know, all of the time, but really they're going to be a tool for you, one that you've probably not thought of that much in those times of disaster. So why? One, it's knowing where you're needed. You know, it's knowing where you need to put your resources. If you know that a pharmacy is open, if you have a relationship with pharmacies in your area and you know which ones are open, or you use something like our Rx Open tool, you'll know where the need is and where there's potentially a place that a person can already go and get a lot of things that they already need, and where there's places where they're not. And additionally, as I said, with situational awareness, they are seeing a lot of things, a lot of things walking through their door. So they're able to really know and see and maybe pick up on trends ahead of time that you might take a little bit of time to see because you won't have all of your test results or other things in front of you. And one of the reasons why I feel strongly that pharmacy is such a great place to look for help is because in a lot of these events, the calls I get at Healthcare Ready are for folks who need chronic care medications and they can't find them in their local pharmacy, or they can't find a pharmacy that's open, and they end up in their emergency room. And I think one of the things we really need to think about is how we partner with pharmacy to make sure that they're still able to stand up. They're able to take some of the surge off those hospitals so the hospitals can focus on what they need to focus on and see what other things we can do to get folks the resources they can in other places. And frankly, they're talking to your public every day. You know, they're the ones there answering all the questions. So they already have a lot of that trust. And if they can help share your messages out to the public as well, that could be incredibly important. And for example, that's what we're seeing right now with Walgreens and with Zika down in Puerto Rico. We're seeing all of the CDC materials being shared out to the public directly, but through the pharmacies is just yet another avenue to make sure that where people are going, they're having a lot of those resources. So in these times of disaster, it's frightening. It's very scary for a patient, especially a patient who has a chronic care condition, and especially a patient who has to evacuate their home, has left all of their medicine behind, potentially left their purse or insurance card behind, can't reach their doctor because one of the first things that close in a lot of these events are doctor's offices. There's a lot of tools here that pharmacy can provide to these patients that can really help them to at least get some of those vital things to make them, you know, get on the road to recovery and resiliency. For one thing, some of these rules change in time of the disaster. So some of the things pharmacy is allowed to do is different than what you would have expected. So in Hurricane Sandy, PDAP vaccines were available for the first time for kids as young as 12, I think. And so you could just go to the pharmacy to get that. And you didn't have to try to find a physician's office that was open. And I'll show you in just a minute, but there's also a lot of tools and a lot of rules that changes that allow the pharmacist to have a lot more authority that maybe they could dispense something without having the script right there, and they can go on a lot of their guts for that. One of the tools that I think is incredibly important to point out, and I hope everyone here goes and looks at the website, it's the EPAP program. It's the Emergency Prescription Assistance Program. So it's a program that's run through HHS, and it is there to provide coverage for uninsured patients in disaster areas. And it's a program that it's been questionable if it was still going to continue on for the last couple of years. But luckily, just within the last couple of weeks, a contract has been signed that has given this program new life. And it's a tool that the state public health has to request during the time of disaster. And then it gets enacted between the feds and the states to actually make sure those patients are getting coverage and make sure that they're filling a lot of those needs. And it was enacted for the last time during Hurricane Sandy, so I'm sure David can talk about that in just a minute. But it's a great resource out there. It's a great resource that that you can pull on to make sure that folks are getting the care they need in more routine environments. Like I mentioned, so there are things that change in emergencies, and especially with pharmacists. Different states allow different things. This map is actually just under a year old at this point, but it's really when refills are allowed and when refills are either all the time or just during times of disaster. So this allows the pharmacist to make a refill without having to have a certain amount of time up. And sometimes these have been, they have different programs like vacation waivers or different things that have allowed it, but different pharmacists have different authorities to make sure that the patient still has enough medicine on their shelf at home. And then on the next slide, so even if they're allowed to dispense, how much is the question? And it really varies. You know, some states you're not allowed to. Some it's a 3-day supply. Some it goes as much as 30 days to reasonable quantity. Again, these are not the highly controlled substances, but these are a great tool for pharmacists to just have the authority. So if you have a patient who comes in and says, I left my medicine at home, I had to go to the shelter, I don't have this capability, what can you do? They can actually do a lot. Thank you. And just taking a minute now to answer yet another poll. So what types of challenges have you or someone you've known faced in accessing care during times of disaster? I'd be very interested to hear where you think some of the biggest challenges are and what you've heard in your history. And just a reminder that if you have questions as we're going through, we'll also pause at the end, but feel free to send them through in the chat feature. Yeah, so it looks like a lot of them are on that prescription thing or finding a healthcare provider. We know it's been one of the biggest challenges is making sure that healthcare providers outside of hospitals are actually open, and it's been a big need. So I think that's really reflected in this as well. On the flip side of that, so we know that pharmacy can be useful to public health and their response. We know that pharmacy can be really useful to patients and making sure they have care. It also is on the flip side where, you know, the only way they can do those things is if they can stay up and running, which is a hard thing. In a lot of my conversations when I've been working with public health and emergency responders, it's a hard thing to think about how do we help these guys help continue their services and be able to provide services. But they have their own needs here. So, you know, manufacturers, if you don't want a shortage of a medicine within the next 6 months, you might not have an immediate issue if you're dealing with manufacturers. But the manufacturers need the knowledge. They need to be able to keep their facilities open. They need to be able to know what's going to be needed down the line and be able to let their employees come to work. Distributors as well, I mean, they're the legs that get things from point A to point B. So they really need help making sure that their folks can get into work, but mostly that trucks can get to the delivery sites where they really need to. And then pharmacies, we see a big need of making sure that, one, that there's people who can unlock the doors and get to work, but two, that there's pharmacists. You know, if a community is impacted, it can be really hard to get a pharmacist from that community to be able to go in and really help. So being able to coordinate at the pharmacy level to see what other pharmacists can come over and making sure we get them the right licenses, the right license waivers, so that they can come in and do what they need to do. And a lot of it just comes down to making sure the folks can get where they need to go, making sure they have the power to do it. And then the clients, the patients themselves, just making sure that they, you know, they're as empowered as they can be. If this EPAP program is enacted, that folks actually know about it, that pharmacists know about it, that people on the ground know about it so that they can actually get the help. And also that they know, you know, yes, you can get a refill. Yes, you can get a waiver. There's a lot of these tools that can get them back up and running. But as you're thinking about it, I bring this up not just to say what challenges they have, but as you're thinking about working with pharmacy and working with partnerships, it's really important to be able to know the things that they care about and know where they hit hiccups throughout it. And that segues into sort of how you do this. And I'm going to talk about this with a pretty high level, and then David's going to talk more into the examples of what he really did. But if you decide that working with pharmacy to increase a lot of these capabilities is what you want to do, this is how you can go about it. And yet another poll. So I'm very interested to hear what part of the pharmaceutical supply chain do you work with? We've talked a lot today about pharmacy. We've talked about the actual dispensing of drugs, not as much about the trucks that move from point A to point B and not so much about the folks that are making the medicines. And so it's very interesting to hear the folks on the ground, who they actually work with. It looks like an interesting split with both distributors and with pharmacists, but again, not as much on the manufacturers. It's really interesting. So what I'll say about that is when you're dealing with the distributors and you're thinking about making your partnerships, the distributors, there's three of them in the country that do 90%+ of all the product. So if you're thinking about things like wanting to know inventory status or wanting to know if you think they're starting to run low on things, or if you've heard reports that things are in shortage and you want to track it down, the distributors are a great source to do that because you're able to hit three places to really understand it. And they're able to have a lot better perspective on what's happening with inventory than, say, the pharmacists who only see what they ordered yesterday and seeing what comes in today. So it's an interesting trend there, just that you have different capabilities, and it can save you a little bit of time to do that. So when you're really trying to create these partnerships, it's really important to understand and try to talk to the folks about in their language. So, you know, the private sector, we think about them, we think about pharmacies in a different way. We think about them as just wanting to make money, just wanting to, you know, have the economics of it. And yeah, of course, they're concerned with going out of business. They're concerned with that. But they're a lot more concerned with keeping their reputation in the space by making sure that their clients, their customers still get what they need and making sure that they're not going to their competitor down the street. And so as you're trying to have these conversations, it's not just them focused on trying to get their funding, but also focused on a lot of those broader things. Just like with you, when they're trying to do those operations, they're very concerned that public sector is just going to create their own supply chain, that they're going to circumvent and not go through what already exists out there. And that's going to be very hard for the stores to navigate. So just being aware of that and learning how they really talk about each other and use a different language to help them try to coordinate with each other. And how do you start? So, I mean, it sounds really nebulous, right? Create a partnership with pharmacy. It sounds like a very big and broad thing. It's best, you know, if you have relationships and you can talk to them, it's really helpful to do that. But if you don't, there's some resources out there. There are states that are already doing a lot of this work, as David will attest in a minute, and cities doing a lot of this work, but also ASTO and NATO. Both have projects going on right now that are looking at pharmacy and are looking at how to work with pharmacy, as well as CDC and HHS have their own projects as well. But trying to identify mutual goals. Understand that not all pharmacy is the same, right? So there's two different major types. You have independents, which are sort of the mom and pop pharmacies, and then you have the big chains, the Walgreens, the CVS, Duane Reade. It's not the same trying to negotiate and work with both of them. If you're trying to get real-time surveillance information, it's often a lot easier to start building those relationships with the independents. It's really hard for these big chains to try to have MOUs and relationships with all of these different local health departments or all of these different state health departments. It can be a really big challenge. And as you're trying to come up with these relationships with them, and I'm just having worked for years now with pharmacy, the lawyers will take forever. So you need to be really specific about what you want, what information you want to be sharing, and how you're going to get it and how you'll work with them. So if you want them to share inventory information, that's hard. They're really nervous about it. They're worried about legal consequences with it. So that will take a lot longer if you'll have to work through a lot of hoops. But if you're interested in something like operating status, there are Walmart and Walgreens both share it out. Walgreens, I know, shares it out with a lot of different state EOCs where you can just see which Walgreens are open. Walmart puts it publicly on their website, so you can see what's there. And they'll also share different information if you need it more specifically. So there's ways to get it a little bit better. And if you're interested in doing things like dispensing, you have to, if you want to figure out how to dispense from your pod, you know, and do some kind of an open pod at a pharmacy, that's a whole different project. And if you're trying to work with the chains with that, recognize that they're probably also working with five other states to do the same thing. And they're going to want to coordinate that all together so that they only have to sign or create one major plan for how to do that and not have it be individualized for each one. And if you can create it into a win-win, I know that sounds obvious, but if you can talk about how you need them to share situational information, surveillance information with you, but you also be there so that you can connect them with the emergency response so that they can help get fuel for their generator or get their employees into work, they're going to be very interested in that. They're going to see it as really something that can be very mutually beneficial with it. And frankly, don't give up, because a lot of these take a long time to develop. But the relationships, you know, that I've seen now that have been going for a number of years are just mutually beneficial and growing and growing. And starting with just interacting on one plane has really grown to really help each other in a lot of different places. And with that, I will pause and I will turn it over to David. Are you on the line?
Yep, thank you, Emily. I guess we'll start. We'll just start right in to what we've our experiences in the last 7 years or so here in New York City. I know a lot of project areas have done a lot of what we've done and probably more. So I'm certainly not claiming, and our group isn't claiming to be sort of the end all of all work that's ever been done with pharmacies. Next slide, please. So first of all, in New York City, we do have, I think we can safely say that we have a fairly strong public health infrastructure. We have very strong public health emergency and hospital preparedness programs. And we do, I think we can also safely say we have a pretty strong medical countermeasure planning and response capacity that we've developed over about a decade of planning. But the pharmacy system up until what you'll see about 7 years ago has really remained untapped, and we're still working through all the vagaries of the system and how best to use it in emergency response. And I think this presentation is going to help you understand what we've encountered over the years, which reinforces a lot of what Emily said in the previous presentations. Next slide. So in New York City, the pharmacy landscape was fairly surprising to us, actually, once we got into the planning and actually started categorizing the pharmacies in the city. We have a lot within the five boroughs of New York City, close to 2,900 retail community pharmacies, and that includes about 700 chain pharmacies. But amazingly, and this actually shocked us as we got this data and sort of analyzed this data, was that there are over 2,100 independent pharmacies. So this, as we realized this, it became apparent to us that we really had to engage independent pharmacies in any sort of pharmacy program as we planned in the future. So now we're going to pause, and we have a poll question here about the landscape of pharmacies of community pharmacies in your jurisdictions, and we're really curious to know if you have a similar experience to us, because we know we're, you know, jurisdictions are, you know, very widely across the country. And please don't, if you don't absolutely know the truth, just answer uncertain, because honestly, we probably would have answered this question incorrectly had we not looked at the exact numbers.
David, this is Emily. I'll hop in a little bit. I'm seeing the answers, the responses as they're coming up right now, and it's overwhelmingly on the chain side, and very few folks who have said it's mostly independent. So I think you're very unique there in New York.
Okay. Well, let me know when you want me to continue.
We'll just give it another second for the poll to finish up. And yeah, it looks like either people, I mean, there's a few that are uncertain, but the overwhelming majority is folks who are in the chain. We're going to close it now. You can go on ahead.
Okay, next slide. So we'll review now some of the past initiatives going back to 2009, that was really 2009 and H1N1 was really the first time we made any real effort to engage pharmacies. And as you'll see, that was actually with the chains. Interestingly, as my team and I went through this, sort of went through the past, we felt like, and we started going through all these different initiatives that we had over the years, we thought we could subtitle our presentation, Mistakes Were Made. But we did learn a lot from all the different initiatives, and I think we're much better off, and hopefully some of you will learn from some of the mistakes we made so that you won't make them. Next slide. So the first thing in H1N1, we were concerned about some spot shortages of antivirals. I think a lot of us experienced those over the course of the pandemic. And at that point, we had no infrastructure to really physically address spot shortages. So what we really focused on was just increasing information flow. We attempted to contact pharmacies and encourage the independent pharmacies to sort of, if they were only signed up and had credit with two distributors, you know, find a third or fourth distributor. Here in New York City, we have about five, and then there's five distributors that distribute into the city on a regular basis. And so we encourage people to have relationships with all five if they could. The other thing is we were attempting to launch a pharmacy locator so that a pharmacy could immediately refer someone to another pharmacy for antivirals, given the time frame that they had to be dispensed and administered in. And we were hoping to, and this was difficult. This is when we first encountered that it's a very, very competitive business. A pharmacy is not going to readily refer someone to a pharmacy nearby because they're likely a competitor. And then the last element of that spot shortage was just we wanted to know about them because I think that so we were encouraged reporting of spot shortages so we could follow up on specific instances. And I think anyone who's been involved in an emergency response has encountered that, where one anecdotal report of a spot shortage suddenly becomes blown out of proportion and ends up being discussed in citywide incident command structures when it hasn't even been verified. So we were trying to encourage reports of that so we could follow up and sort of tamp them down. This one store didn't have any antivirals for an hour, and so on and so forth. We didn't do a great job, to be honest, in this. Things moved so quickly. There weren't widespread spot shortages, so that was kind of self-resolved. There wasn't a lot of focus on that. And then, of course, if any of you were around then, we went right into planning for the fall vaccination campaigns. But the other program during H1N1 that we thought was unique, but I think a lot of people did something like this, was trying to ensure access to the antivirals to the economically disadvantaged because they were so expensive through this antiviral access program, where we actually took some of our SNS received antivirals and got agreement with some of the chains in the city to accept those and distribute them to their stores. And then we contacted providers and, you know, sent out various messages through Hans and commissioner letters and things like that, encouraging providers to sort of follow a short little algorithm to make sure that when they prescribed an antiviral that the recipient of the prescription could actually pay for it. And if they ascertained that they couldn't and that they would likely not fill the prescription, they could write "fill from New York City Supply" on the prescription, go to one of those stores, and the store would dispense it for a small administration fee, dispense it from our stockpile for a small administration fee. So we ended that program, I think it went all the way through the spring, and the lessons learned during H1N1 were that it is difficult to coordinate sort of emergency response across a very competitive industry, and there was a tremendous difficulty in tracking product that is not part of a corporation standard formulary. So I think I can feel a lot of emergency planners around the country right now nodding distribution of this stuff is easy, but reverse logistics and recovery is not. So we got back things that we hadn't shipped. We got back more, in some cases, we got back more than we shipped in the first place. So that was very, very challenging to close that program out. And to be honest, in the end, we never were able to gather perfect data on how well it was accessed and whether it was actually a success and and helps a significant number of people or not. Next slide, please. So then a few years later, the next year, that sort of got piqued our interest about working with the pharmacy, with the pharmacies in general. And so we conceived this idea of a public health emergency response network pharmacy program. Sounds a very long acronym, but the idea was we wanted to increase supply levels at the regional level by increasing, like having sort of stocks at distributor locations, and then also increasing supplies at the store level so that stores would be encouraged to have a few extra bottles of antibiotics on hand, knowing that there would always be like a sort of a rush on the pharmacies. And that store level inventory would be items that we actually purchased for them. And we had a lot of discussions with the chains. We actually visited most of the distributor warehouses that came in. And we started talking to the New York City Pharmacist Society, which is sort of the only group that could sort of represent the independent pharmacies in the city. The idea was that these, you know, if anybody's worked with a pharmacy, there's such an emphasis on reducing costs and sort of just-in-time inventory, so that very rarely will you find more than like a 500-count bottle of doxycycline on a store shelf. And our idea was that we would buy three extra bottles, so they would all, and then they would sort of be required to have maintained those four bottles on their shelves and rotate them as they dispense normally. And then during an emergency, we could notify them, and then they would dispense that stuff free, and we would reimburse for an administration fee. Now, of course, because there were so many independents, we knew we had to engage the independents, and we found quickly that the lessons learned from this, it was really that the administrative burden made the program infeasible for anything but the chains. And to be honest, I think to reiterate something that Emily said, in our work with the chains, if you're going to work with a chain, you need to have a very clear ask, a very clear sort of, this is what we need from you, and you'll see we went through that in some of the later initiatives. Very clear ask for what they respond to the best. They're very good partners, and they're very willing to help, but they are constrained by sort of the corporate entity, and I think in the independent world, where you're constrained by sort of its disparate nature. It's all over the place, and there's no one representative body. So the administrative burden that we saw with the independents is that every single independent would have had to register with a hand-filled W-9 to become an official vendor for the city for us to reimburse them after the event. So we realized this really was too much for us to take on, given the numbers we were talking about. And then we did, however, get the support of the State Board of Pharmacy, and the Executive Secretary of the State Board of Pharmacy has been very supportive, and this is one of the first times we engaged them, and the relationship has continued from that day. And secondly, the New York City Pharmacist Society seemed very eager to support us in other initiatives, even if this one didn't work out. So we immediately had these two contacts, that both of which have carried forward from that you know, quote, failed program. Now we're going to stop, I guess. Emily, this is a poll.
Yeah, we're going to take a pause again and ask a poll to everyone. Does your mass dispensing plan include private sector partners? So please just take a second to answer that on the right-hand side. And actually, while people are answering that question, and we're going to close it in a minute, somebody came up with a note through the messaging system as you were talking about what you were doing in H1N1. And they were saying that they tried the same procedure with their antivirals, but their legal department shut it down, and they weren't allowed to do it. So it's interesting that other places have thought of the same things, but there's been challenges. Do you have any advice for folks that have been having trouble with getting legal to approve some of these partnerships? David, are you on mute?
Yeah, I was on mute. We were sort of conferring. I honestly would have to go back and look at exact, but we got agreement from legal for that because they had to sign agreements. We had an MOA with the
new lobby.
Yeah. But go ahead. Do you,
so this is the beauty. I think what there's also been some changes in the legal landscape in terms of how to distribute inventory that not a track inventory that pharmacies get, and certainly the corporate world is a little bit more keen on addressing those and making sure that they're in the clear with that. So recently, if any of the folks have had experience doing this, they might have faced a little bit more of a legal hindrance maybe, because it's certainly been on everybody's radar screen, but it's been a little bit tougher recently to be able to secure inventory and be able to rotate and give out things that, you know, are not normally kind of, you know, started from the supply chain, from the actual corporate entity, if that makes sense.
That's more recent.
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, that's more recent, though, so they were encountering this even back in H1N1. I really think that that's dependent on your legal, your own legal, your general counsel. Our general counsel tends to be very willing to sort of be accommodating more than I think a lot of, from what we've heard from other jurisdictions even.
Yeah, but I do think some of those challenges might continue, so it really does put the importance on trying to pre-plan for a lot of these events.
Yeah,
and I think the one thing that we've also learned is in the planning phase, the more information you can give to legal early on makes them a little bit less conservative to respond to these kinds of things when time actually comes. That's definitely a lesson learned.
Now it looks like the poll's now closed. Everyone should have the information up, and it looks like most people do think about the private sector. At least a quarter of folks do as they're coming up with their plans.
All right, then we'll move on.
Yep.
So the next initiative we encountered, I think most people encountered these reports of spot shortages over the last few years. I think this we really started doing this in 2011. But because of those previous initiatives, we now had contact names and people who knew who we were with the chain pharmacies, with the distributors, as well as the independent pharmacies through the Pharmacists Association. So when we got, this is when we as the countermeasures group here in the health department, people started looking to us to get any information on the pharmaceutical supply chain, which was sort of, so we were sort of carving out a niche. So as these reports came in, they would get funneled to us, and we sat around and said, well, what are we going to do? We have no ability to follow up on it, because we never could get good information on where the report came from. So what we did is we started producing a report by calling all of our contacts, as you described in your previous presentations, and just saying we didn't want specific inventories, just, you know, whatever information they would give us. And sometimes it was very vague, we're fine, you know, it would be, you know, or we would get very detailed, sort of like, well, we're back ordered for a few days on the 30 milligram tablets or something like that. So we started producing these reports, and it really tamped down all the concern of these anecdotal reports, because we were producing them regularly, and then people just stopped asking for them because they realized there, you know, any shortage that was there, if there was one, had resolved at that point. And the lesson learned from this is really that we were able to continually build on those relationships that we already had developed, and then that a lot of times just providing information as fast as you can and disseminating it as widely as you can reduce the level of concern. So when some city council person called the health department and said somebody's reporting shortage, they can't get Tamiflu in their district, that we would just have this report. Look, this is what the chains are saying. This is what the Independent Pharmacy Society is saying. And this is what the so there really isn't a spot shortage. And providing that information, detailed information rapidly, really eliminated a lot of the concern. And we stopped getting the requests. Now, moving on to Hurricane Sandy. So I think there are probably quite a few jurisdictions on the phone that had a difficult experience during Hurricane Sandy. We certainly did, and we were talking before this, and we actually said before Hurricane Sandy hit, we were like, well, countermeasures, we don't have anything to do with hurricane response, so we'll just sit back and offer our services wherever they were needed. And then very quickly, we started getting questions about medication access and pharmacies that were open in the affected areas. So we'll get to what we did. But so what happened with Hurricane Sandy, some of the problems we had were the problems with medication access that Emily previously described, things like people had lost their prescriptions, they ran out, they lost their insurance information, they didn't have money for copays, they didn't have money at all. and so on and so forth. A lot of people refused to evacuate. So there were, you know, a lot of people that we had to support, or at least support the infrastructure that was in place, because they would not go to shelters. We had very, I'm referring to communication with pharmacies. We had a lot, well, we had no ability, really no effective communication ability to communicate directly with pharmacies on a large scale, So we couldn't contact all of the pharmacies in the city. We couldn't contact all of the smaller groups and at the beginning of the response. And then the other thing that was really unique is that pockets of us, of New York City, depend on independent pharmacies. And I'm going to show you a series of maps in a second. But so in the Rockaways, which is one of the most heavily affected areas in the city, which is a peninsula off of Queens, there are 23 pharmacies at the time. 18 of those were independent, and only 5 chain pharmacies were there. So it was a geographically isolated area, and it was one of the most severely affected areas in the city. So I'm going to show you a slide. You can go very quickly. There's a slide of all of New York City. That's the entire, all the 5 boroughs. Then the next is, that's Queens. That's the borough of Queens. So when we called the New York City, we were talking to the New York City Pharmacy Society, and we said, we're having a lot of problems. He said, yeah, but I'm getting reports that 80% of the pharmacies in Queens are open. Now, the next slide shows you the Rockaways. So the Rockaways were where most of the pharmacies had in Queens. Most of the 20% of the pharmacies that were out of commission were in the Rockaways. And if you can see, there are some bridges that go across the middle of that marshy area in the middle and broad channel. But for the most part, immediately after Sandy, all transport and physical access had to go through that tiny little area over on the right-hand side from the main body of Queens. So this geographic isolation was something that we were, that was fairly unique and kind of surprised us. So we really put a lot of focus into supporting the pharmacies in that area.
And there are also other pockets, for example, in Manhattan, which we think of as densely populated and there's access everywhere and lots of pharmacies, but there are still pockets of neighborhoods where, because of bridges and different kind of highways, patients are really restricted to their neighborhood community pharmacy, independent pharmacy, and it's a little bit not so feasible for them to actually access a few blocks away since they're, you know, on the other side of a highway, for example.
Right. So then some about the hurricane, the response, what we quickly cobbled together was we requested and received a list of all the pharmacies licensed with New York State Board of Pharmacy, all the pharmacies in New York City. Well, we got the whole list, and then we sorted out for New York City. And then we geocoded and mapped all the pharmacies in the inundation zone. And then by contact, we manually contacted pharmacies in the inundation zone that we had numbers for, focusing on the Rockaways, and we also had some field staff that were out there that were gathering information, and we produced open-closed reports for dissemination both on the website, but also we were sending them to be printed and distributed in the areas where that were most severely affected. And what we found is that a lot of places were actually, they were dispensing medications even without power or any kind of communication. And that was something that surprised us. You know, some of the independent, the guy would just open up for an hour or two a day just to make sure his clients were served with what they needed. So the lessons we learned from this is that we had no comprehensive citywide pharmacy facility list. And without that sort of list covering the universe of pharmacies in the city, we had little to no capacity for effective targeted communication to pharmacies either before an emergency or during or after. And this is something that, you know, this sort of clarified our approach in the future, because we realized, yeah, we can't do anything if we don't know what's there. So one of the first things that we did was we wanted to follow up and sort of close out the Hurricane Sandy response, and we conducted a survey in 2013. Go to the next slide. And we surveyed the pharmacies in these severely affected areas in Coney Island, Staten Island, also the South Shore of Staten Island, Coney Island, and the Rockaways, of course, were all hit pretty hard. So we surveyed them asking some questions about power and their access to supplies and staffing, legal problems and things like that. And the findings are up there. It's pretty clear. We had about 35 responses to the 52 we reached out to. 23 of them were independent, 12 chains. 80% of those pharmacies lost power, but this was not always cited as a major concern, which really surprised us. Some of them were able to. Now we're talking about loss of grid power, so they loss of the power of the city, you know, provided across the city. So some of them had little generators and things like that to keep refrigerators going. The damages included, of course, the loss of revenue, loss of medication, inventory, and equipment. But surprisingly, most of them were able to reopen in less than a month. And 76 of those reopened with normal or close to normal hours compared to their situation pre-hurricane. A lot of them were able to open in just a matter of days, too. So we have an article on this that's under peer review right now.
It's officially been accepted.
So as of yesterday, I believe. So we'll send out some information on that. But again, this highlighted our need for effective communication with pharmacies, particularly during emergencies. There's another poll we'd like to conduct.
Yes, thank you. So please take a second to answer the final poll. Do you have a plan to alleviate disaster-related spot shortages in your area? And while that's going, actually, a question that came through that I have an opinion on, but I think you might as well on your team, especially Vibhuti. So if a patient doesn't have their medication and doesn't know what they're taking, how is it handled? Even if the state is allowed to have refills, say going up to 30 days without a prescription, how does the pharmacist know if you don't show up with an empty bottle or whatever else, how do they know what to dispense?
Yeah, so I mean, usually, so with the independent pharmacies, it's a little bit easier because they usually also have relationships with their clients, and it's actually surprising how much pharmacists know about who's on what medication. So they're, with the emergency waivers that are usually issued within a state in the times of an emergency, the pharmacist can kind of use their judgment to see. So, you know, if somebody comes and says, I am on lisinopril, a blood pressure for my blood pressure, and I need whatever milligrams a couple of days to get me by, those medications are easier to refill, and the pharmacist probably will use their judgment to just say, okay, either they're familiar or, you know, truth be told, it's not such a high-stakes medication, unlike a controlled substance, for example. So for chronic medications, it's usually not that hard in that kind of a situation to go up to the pharmacist, and they do their best to kind of refill it. And the same goes for chains. Usually they'll have some corporate guidance in terms of, you know, do the best you can, but, you know, if you definitely know somebody needs their medication for an emergency, do your best to fill it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I hear and what I tell folks as well. The challenge isn't often, as long as it's not one of those highly controlled substances, it's not often proving that they're taking the prescription. It's just making sure we have it to give it to them and finding a way to make that happen. One other question that came through as we're closing the poll, but if you were able to secure a list of pharmacy from the Board of Pharmacies, why was it not up to date in order to communicate with? And secondarily to that, did you think about using the actual Board of Pharmacy to be your intermediary to actually to communicate out with all of those pharmacies?
Well, this goes back to, so the information was up to date. It's just that there are no emails in the list that we get from the licensing data. So depending, you know, other jurisdictions may have more contact information in their license, but the things that are gathered as part of the licensing is basically all we got was a store phone number. The other thing is this goes back to when we asked the State Board of Pharmacy about what was going on in Queens support, is that there are over 10,000 pharmacies in the state. So we're still, you know, they were dealing with a lot of issues in the rest of the state as well, because some of the areas in upstate New York were affected by dramatically, and out on Long Island were dramatically affected by Sandy. So in this case, there were some counties where he had less than 80%. This is why that became so needed. Less than 80% of the pharmacies were open. So when they saw us in Queens having over 80% open, we're fine. We're off their list of sort of focus. So there, I think that's why the State Board of Pharmacies, we are only part of the responsibilities that they have.
Yeah, and I think one other thing to appreciate is that the granular view that we have on the grassroots of New York City is very different from what kind of the high-level view that the state will have, particularly because you're dealing with, 20% of the entire state's pharmacies, but that are completely different than the rest of the entire state's pharmacy, because there's certainly a lot bigger chain presence in the outside of New York City. And so it's just a very different frame of work. And also, I think that the independent owners, although they did turn to the state board of pharmacy for some legal language in terms of the emergency waivers for prescriptions, the information about whether they're open, how long they're open, how they're actually dealing with patients and clients on the ground was something that only really we were privy to, and the higher level sort of board will not have that information. So, for example, we had residents at a local hospital calling. I know I got phone calls about, like, can you tell me, does the pharmacy deliver? Or, you know, people were in high rises and they're elderly and don't have insulin, all those kinds of things. I think as much as we could partner with the state board, we did, but certainly Hurricane Sandy was the one big time that we realized that the need for this kind of communication infrastructure is really high.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, so dovetailing on a lot of that, but also how we directly deal with dispensing in these pharmacies, another question came through talking about children in disasters. So did you have anything you needed to do to address children patients who needed controlled substances during Hurricane Sandy, things, medications for ADD or ADHD? Did you have to deal with that at all?
No, not really. I think the only thing anecdotally that I remember was seizure medications for certain children, or I think what you're probably referring to is a lot of Ritalin kind of medication for controlled substances, but we didn't. I know that the emergency waiver doesn't cover the control supply, so control medication, so that's just not something that was kind of talked about.
Yeah, we have heard of, again, anecdotally, but challenges with a lot of those special populations, and I think there are some efforts now to look at some of those, but it sure has seemed like a gap from now. And our poll is closed, and I think from the responses there, I think we can pretty safely say that there hasn't been a lot of consideration in thinking about dealing with spot shortages during those times of disaster. So David will advance it one more slide.
Okay. And then one of the more recent initiatives we had, where we had the idea, and I think others, we talked to some of the other jurisdictions about this, about the idea of sort of injecting supplies that we had into the supply chain above the pharmacies, sort of, so into the distributor supply chain. So we sort of toyed with this idea of taking antivirals and then lending basically, you know, you can't sell them, but you would lend them to the distributor, who would then fill their orders using the supplies that we provided at per normal charging, you know, per their normal pricing structure and billing and so forth. And then when the shortage was resolved, they would reimburse us with product. So we thought it was a way to get back some, you know, up-to-date product for some of the ones that were approaching expiration. And we issued an RFI, request for information, to the distributors in the region, and three out of the seven, we have five primary, but there are five main distributors that come into the city, but there are two that are a little further away. They distribute some product, so we reached out to them as well. So of the seven, three replied, and as you can see, we got one yes, one no, and one not sure, but effectively no. And of the no, there was a, you know, they stated basically in the response that their corporate policy involved purchasing directly from the pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributing only those products to their customers. So the lesson learned here goes back to that, you know, this is a very reasonable corporate policy. They want to know the provenance of their drugs, and they wanted to use existing relationships and from their existing formulary. And then I think, you know, now the Drug Supply Chain Security Act may be affecting some of our emergency planning, and we've encountered this in some of our distribution planning for nursing homes and things like that, where the medical directors are saying, well, what about the DSCSA? How will that affect us? So we're really waiting. I think the FDA is still working through that to give guidance on how that affects emergency planning and response. So finally, very quickly, really this is the focus of our efforts now. After this has sort of really come to fruition in 2015, but it had been going on effectively since 2013, throughout 2014. But we now have a geocoded classified database of all New York City pharmacies. They're classified whether they're community, hospital, distributor, whether they're chain, independent. We've assigned them hurricane, we've mapped them to hurricane evacuation zones. We know which ones are operating under the DOHMH standing order for vaccination. We have them mapped to police precincts. Everything, any kind of information that we could merge with this, we did. And we do get monthly updates about changes in ownership and supervising pharmacists and stuff like that from the New York State Board of Pharmacy, so we integrate that in. I think Eric has been managing that for years, and who bought who just recently that's causing a bunch of updates?
CVS isn't going into writing.
Right, or Target?
Target.
Target going into CVS, Target just bought writing.
Right, so there's been a lot of changes, so we get these updates and we're having to change all the
classifications.
So the lessons learned from this is really it gives us a much better ability to understand the full universe of New York City pharmacies and also to explore geographic relationships between sort of the areas of the city who depend on them as well as community programs and play other healthcare facilities in the area. It's really fascinating to be able to look at it in this way and down to community districts and community boards and things like that. Because as the beauty said earlier, you can have a geographically isolated place that would show up immediately, but once you start mapping it, you can say, oh, that's actually a place that we have to focus on. So the future work here, next slide, is really we reoriented that FERNPP idea, the Public Health Emergency Response Network Pharmacy Program idea, away from mass dispensing and more onto to focus on building a direct relationship and gathering information from the pharmacies in the city so that we could sort of build out that facility database into and be able to communicate with pharmacies, targeted communications, mapped communications, citywide communications, and so we could communicate with them in the planning phase as well as the response phase. And we recently launched a registration site where pharmacies can register and provide this additional information that we're requesting in just a few minutes, and then we will actually prompt them every 6 months, is this information correct, and so on. And the chain pharmacies have been very supportive. We're working with them to get their database. Of course, the chains will not want you to contact their stores directly. I can say that with full confidence. The chains will always want you to go through the corporate office, which is, again, perfectly reasonable. But they are still willing to provide us sort of all the other detailed information, vaccines, and other information that we're requesting. And New York State Board of Pharmacy is very enthusiastic, and we're beginning the recruitment process to fill the rest of the fields in there. We're really eager to get as many of those pharmacies registered as possible. And the next slide. And the final slide. Our real effort right now is to get as many of the pharmacies in the city into that pharmacy program and gather the information and continually update their information. And we're developing communications plans for different scenarios. For example, we almost got hit, or there was talk of being hit with a hurricane last year, and we quickly came up with sort of a basic. We had the ability at that point at least make phone calls to these pharmacies to notify pharmacies who are in evacuation zones, for example, and then also notify all pharmacies in the city that there may be shelters opening in their neighborhoods with displaced people. They may have a larger number of people who are not their normal customers, and to remind them of any waivers that the State Board of Pharmacy would issue in that case, things like that. We're also going to encourage the use of the facility database to expand our sort of relationship with them as partners in other public health initiatives. I know Vibuti has been involved in the naloxone program, and there are a variety of other public health initiatives which can really benefit from having sort of a citywide database of pharmacies rather than just reaching out to the same pharmacies all the time, which tends to happen. These early adopters get tagged for new initiatives all the time. And then finally, honestly, we are going to go back and look at some of those programs that didn't quite work out before and see if this having better contact information and better information on the pharmacies could maybe move those forward if possible. And I think I've talked enough, and I will stop and allow the discussion to proceed. Thank you.
Great, thank you. That was fascinating. So we have a few minutes now, actually a little over 15 minutes, to have some question and answer. Operator, could you remind people how they could lodge a question?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Great. And while those are coming in, I actually received a question over the messaging, but it's actually something that I've been hearing from a few different places. So they were wondering, David or New York City folks, if you could talk about other concerns and what you've been hearing with the implementations of the DSCSA law, basically the track and trace traceability law that is going throughout the pharmaceutical supply chain right now in the United States.
I think it's really the one group that brought it up was the nursing homes. And until they brought it up, we hadn't even, I mean, we'd been sort of trying to remain aware of it, but we hadn't really looked at it as a barrier for our emergency planning. And we have talked to the FDA and they've indicated they too have sort of preliminarily realized that it could be an issue for emergency preparedness and that they'll be working on something, but we don't have anything.
And Emily, this is Greg. For the Strategic National Stockpile, we've already been in discussion with FDA about giving us a blanket exemption for track and trace for our countermeasures.
Oh, that's really reassuring. Yeah, I've certainly heard that. I think the challenge is this law is going into effect over 7 or 8 years, and it's hitting different parts of the supply chain at different times, and every phase of it that's been implemented so far has been implemented with a delay or with advice coming in of how to implement it pretty late. And so I think it's just a little bit too early to say exactly how it's going to impact in a lot of these events. But I've heard it's been raised of concerns of what it'll happen for dispensing, but also what impact is it going to have on donations in those events. And I think the hope is that there will always be waivers or things that can happen to get around that. But it certainly has been a concern that's been raised. Do we have any questions on the line? Okay, well, I received one other one. So, David, if you're in a city or a state, not a ton of resources, not a lot of time, as I think is probably common across it, what kind of partnerships, I mean, what's the most bang for the buck? What should people be trying to look to do with lower levels of effort that might have the most value in their community? Because New York City is doing some amazing stuff, but you can tell that it's been an absolute ton of effort and labor to get it to that point.
So I think what I would suggest, this is a beauty again, would reach out to your local professional pharmacy associations. I think that the easiest pull, just to even learn about what pharmacy issues there are, what are the big kind of hot tickets, hot topics, the barriers, and the opportunities that you can partner with them. I think the pharmacy associations tend to be comprised of the early adopters and the champion pharmacists. In the very least, you'll learn about the landscape of what pharmacy looks like in your community, and then also get the contacts for your chain presence, your independence, any health system issues you need to worry about. So I think that would definitely be. And then also don't forget to partner with your local schools or colleges of pharmacy, because they usually have a lot of people who can dedicate efforts to building these partnerships, and it's a really fruitful effort. That's actually how I came to David with this. So I think that's another thing to think about.
And also try to educate your pharmacist on the EPAP program before an emergency really occurs. That really helps out in terms of getting access for medications to patients very quickly. So knowing about the program before an accident or emergency really helps a lot in terms of getting medication to the people very quickly.
And
that's
the pharmacist,
a great point.
They're quite eager to, you know, get speakers for their continuing education programs, for example. So that's a great way to get an audience with the pharmacist and also their board meeting. So I think explore the way and kind of form the partnership there first and see what's there.
Absolutely. And one other note about the EPAP program, pharmacies can register electronically for it, and they can do it in advance of an event. So you don't have to wait till something happens. And if they have registered ahead of time, then they're going to be getting notifications when it's kicked on. So the more folks that are aware of it, the more value that can be. And one of the biggest challenges that I saw during Sandy with EPAP was that making sure that pharmacies throughout the day and through different shifts knew about the program, because it's one thing if one pharmacist sets it up and is aware of it, but then they go home at night. It can be hard to make sure that all of the rest of the ones for the following days know about the program as well. So spreading the word of that is really helpful. And operator, do you want to ping for it one more time?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. And we do not have any questions at this time.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for participating today. This has been a great conversation of a resource that I don't think we always think about front and center in preparedness. So hopefully it changes a little bit about how you think you could work with them and what things to do about it. Of course, we are available to help answer any questions offline as you're starting to think about things and help you figure out who to talk to as you're sort of starting down the path on a lot of this. And just a reminder that our previous webinar on navigating the pharmaceutical supply chain is now available on our website. Right now it's just the slides. We'll have the full recording with audio up in the next week. And we have two more in this series. One is going to be on inventory management, but focused on shortages, and one is going to be on pharmaceutical regulation. So look for those June 6th and June 23rd to understand more about how you can actually operate in these environments and how do we fix some of the things that are happening. And Greg, do you have any closing words?
Thanks, Emily. I appreciate it. And I want to thank particularly you and all of our good partners in New York City for the work that they put into helping put this on today. I think that these are probably very valuable. And I would love to hear from some of our partners at the state and local level, particularly if you want to give us a call at some point. Let us know what you think about these and what other topics we might consider including in future webinars that would kind of continue to your education around the SNS, the things that we do, how pharmaceuticals and medical devices might need to be handled in an emergency situation that has nothing to do with SNS or our deployments, or just anything else you'd like to hear from us about. But again, thanks all of you. We really appreciate the work that you put into this and the work that you put into getting yourself to the point that you're at a place to talk to us about these important things. We look forward to seeing most of you again next time at our next webinar. Please share this information with your colleagues so that we can continue to do these and support you in this way. Thanks, and I'll drop out.
Great. Thank you all, and that ends the webinar.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.